Thank you. Chris Bizzaro, now I know the right thing to say is that you never want to follow Chris. Where are you? Thank you for the joke. And Harold, when you invited me to give this speech, and I said first thing to you, I would love to do it, but I really don't know anything about advertising, and I probably will bore the audience. You said, really, really, trust me, it's going to be okay, and this will be relevant. But he promised that we could kind of split the time. So I'm going to talk about interop as a theory and this book that we've written, and then we're going to have a conversation. He's going to help ground it appropriately in your industry. Harold also told me that he's read this book twice, and I don't think anybody, including my mother, has ever read anything that I've written twice. The topic of interop is one that I think is very broadly applicable, and one that has, once you start thinking in interop terms, sometimes you can't stop thinking that way, so it's a, kind of an interesting thing. In a really, really simple way, think about all those extra phone chargers. There are millions of pounds of extra phone chargers out there every year produced because there's a lack of interoperability in terms of things working with one another. Those are simple forms of interop or lack of interop, but there are much more profound versions of interop and lack of interop. Since we're in New York, I think the most profound example is what happened after 9/11. You may know of this case study, but there was a lot of review of the way in which the fire department and the police department and other first responders actually couldn't talk to one another. Their systems were not particularly interoperable, and some of the response to the 9/11 attacks was actually to think about how these systems might be able to talk to one another. There was another level of review at that same time about the intelligence agencies and how the information and the people in the intelligence agencies weren't talking to one another. That's a somewhat more profound example of why interop matters these days. The work that we've done is actually based on a really, really simple definition. I figured we would start there, which when we talk about interop, it's the ability to transfer or render useful data and other information across systems, and that includes organizations, applications, or components. I prefer, though, a different definition, which is the art and science of working together. We often think about this in really strict and technical terms, but I actually think it's as much as anything, it's about humans, and it's about your audience and how they're interacting with things, including the information that you are trying to serve to them in the advertising context. There's another way to look at it, which is to say, what's the summation of this theory? I would say that it's important to think about it as having these different layers. So there are technological forms of interoperability, as well as data interoperability, as well as human and institutional interoperability. So when we're talking about that 9/11 example, the institutional working together of the fire department with the police department is just as important in a way as the signals being able to go across from one to the next. You think about what are the benefits of interoperability in general across the case studies that one might study. Innovation is clearly a high one, so systems and industries that have higher levels of interoperability tend to have high levels of shared innovation, which is obviously thought of as a positive thing. It does breed a certain degree of competition, generally speaking, so industries that have lower levels of interoperability often have larger and more entrenched players, whereas industries that have higher levels of interop, and my sense is that your industry is getting higher and higher levels of interop over time. That will be bad, obviously, for some large entrenched players in terms of their ability to control the market, and it will be quite wonderful for others in a competitive sense. That tends to be the pattern that we see. It does tend to lead to autonomy and flexibility and choice, again, at higher levels of innovation within the stack, and we tend to think of that, at least in an academic sense, as a positive thing. It also fosters access, diversity, and openness, some of the things like transparency that you were talking about in the earlier panel. There are absolutely risks associated with interop, and I will zip through some of them later. One of them that's often thought about is privacy and security for individuals. That is not necessarily something that has to go down when it comes to interoperability, but it often does, and it's something that people think about how to guard against. And we'll get later to the kinds of approaches that accomplish interoperability along the way as well. This is another way to look at the theory and to split it up in different areas. Technological, I think, is probably most of what we'll talk about here, which is literally sharing information across different things, which is the data over on the far right. I would definitely urge you, though, to not to forget the layers of human and institutional kinds of interoperability, because I think in the end those end up being as important as the technical sides of it. Here are a couple of the key findings, just to cut to the chase from a number of years of research into interoperability. Very often solutions to big societal problems depend upon getting interoperability right. Interoperability is hugely relevant both to the public sector and to the private sector. So a public sector example would be one of the most famous examples in interop is thinking about how air traffic control systems actually have come to work together around the world. That's a public sector issue that we had to get right so that your plane lands successfully and takes off successfully. Obviously what you're working on here might be a really good example of private sector interop. I see interop as actually a design challenge. It's a design challenge because, in a sense, you've got people who are competing and seeking to do different things together, but also separately, and yet you need to work together in order to make things happen. And it's also a design challenge that happens at multiple layers, that's, again, in terms of the technology and the data and so forth. When you're looking at interoperability, you, generally speaking, are not seeking maximum interoperability. You're usually seeking optimal interoperability. So there are times in which if you have something to be too interoperable, it's actually not a good thing. And if there's too little interoperability, that also cannot be a good thing. So you're often thinking about trying to find where is that optimal amount of interop within any given system. And then again, there are many benefits of that, which we can push further into later. This is just another way to look at that layers. I'm so glad that you mentioned layers. This is how I often stack them. I think the technological is the most simple and the one that in some ways is most obvious. Making sure then data can flow over that is crucial. I would then put the human layer above that, and the institutional layer might be the organizations, the rules, the norms, some of the things, again, that panel was getting at. And in order to have an optimally interoperable system or an interoperable field, there has to be interoperability across all of these four layers. Oopsie. Okay, so let's go a little bit deeper into some of these benefits and use a few examples. I think one of the companies mentioned earlier, Facebook, is one of the places that has benefited the most from interoperability. If you think about the growth of that company, Facebook obviously was very successful right from the start, but there was a moment when it opened up its social network to other people to be able to develop applications on top of it, and you saw an enormous amount of growth at that moment. So they decided not to be a particularly closed system, but to create a way in which to be interoperable with lots of other gaming platforms and others. That was a hugely important moment. I think if you look at Twitter, they have also made a choice to allow some interaction with third-party platforms, but they have not decided to be a particularly interoperable system, right? They made a different choice. And I think you can see in some ways the effect of those kinds of decisions for these companies. Those are obviously not the only two distinctions between the companies, but I think if you think about the different interoperability strategies of different social media companies, you can also track where some of their growth has come from. That was on the private sector side. On the public sector side, one of the things that's been really interesting is to see how higher levels of interoperability have allowed people to solve social problems together. This is an example from a nonprofit called Ushahidi, and they set up a system right after some of the natural disasters in Haiti, and set up a system that would allow people to identify where they were and where the greatest need was, and to try to allow aid workers to go very quickly into Haiti to match the aid to where the area of greatest need was. There are a whole bunch of examples in the social sector of really high levels of interop that have actually led to life-saving interventions. So I think you can chart interop in terms of the effect it can have on particular companies. You can also chart it in terms of lives saved and ways in which the public sector uses it effectively. So in terms of innovation, I think you can also think about it as a series of cycles. So often innovation then leads to a different level of competition and leads to a different level of innovation. And I would expect that in an industry that is becoming more and more interoperable, that's what one would be likely to see. There are a bunch of different theories of innovation. This is where, if one were giving an academic conference presentation, which I am not, you would cite some of these other theorists. I'm happy to push into any of those as well, who look at particular forms of innovation that derive from the interop levels that you create. I would also say that there is a caveat, which is certainly in the context of trying to drive higher levels of interoperability, where we say mostly it drives more competition, there can be anti-competitive behavior, obviously, and sometimes to be the one who has driven a standard successfully then leads to anti-competitive behavior. So that's an obvious point, I think, but worth making. So it's the point being, it's not just that if you have interop, you're definitely going to have more competition. You have a different environment in which you can have more competition, but it's not necessarily something that flows from it particularly. Let me share a few of the downsides associated with interoperability, and there are some. I think the primary way to see the downsides is if you have a series of systems that are at one point discrete from one another and you start to connect them, and it does seem that's actually listening to this previous panel, if you were thinking about the way in which ads were served at one point across different media, they were completely disconnected. Now they're increasingly connected. I think it makes it obvious that there are potential risks associated with that. As I mentioned before, those primary ones that people think about are information privacy and security. So you might think about this in the sense of of buildings. So if you have buildings that are completely disconnected and there are a series of 50 different keys, if you only can bring one key to one door, there's not that much risk that something can go from one place to another and cause a security breach. As soon as you put everything onto one system, in theory, of course, somebody who breaks into it once can break into 50 different buildings, right? It doesn't mean it's less secure, but it makes that possibility exist. And the same thing is true, certainly, from a consumer privacy perspective. So this is not a conference on privacy, but one might, often in the context of interop, one of the fears that is brought up is that somebody's information, which is in one place, used to just be in that one place. Now it's on a system that's, of course, much more broadly accessible. And therefore, whether it's either by hacking or it's by sharing that information, there obviously are consumer risks there and something that that some set of people are worried about. So interoperability, I guess the point is not necessarily an unalloyed good. And it does bring things that one would have to guard against or to think in various terms about how we would protect against those downsides. I would say that these are the primary drawbacks of high degrees of interoperability. I think the benefit, though, of thinking about it in that way is that you also can have a great deal of diversity in a positive way that is connected, where things can exist on the same system and yet also talk to one another. So that's kind of the flip side. I do believe overall that these are risks that in almost any system are outweighed by the benefits, and they're ones just that need to be designed into effectively. And I think what it does is it says that this really is a design challenge. It's a challenge where at the outset, if you're concerned about something like privacy and security, you need to design for that at the outset. So I would say for an industry where interoperability is increasing, that thinking about those things as design challenges at the beginning will save potential problems later on. Okay, how do you get to higher degrees of interoperability? It seems like that is happening here, but let me give you some notes about it. One is it often takes a long time. It rarely happens very quickly, except in a brand new industry. Social media would be an example of something brand new. Something with legacy systems, obviously, can take a much longer period of time. The way we've been studying this has been the research has happened at a place called the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, where I used to teach. And we've done it by industries, and so we've got case studies on each of these industries. We have not done one on your industry. I think somebody should write the ad industry interop study, and it'll be fascinating. But if you look at different industries and how they've become more and more interoperable, they all have slightly different stories. So in the case of healthcare, it's been a very slow process of getting, for instance, to electronic medical records that are interoperable. It's happening, but it's in part because there's so many actors and there's so much complexity in that way. Air traffic control is another one of the famous examples. That has enormously, enormously powerful legacy issues involved. And I would say a third example where it's really interesting interop is the smart grid as it's developing. In that case, there's just such a high level of complexity that has caused it to happen very slowly. I do think it's important to note the varying ways in which interop has come about in different industries. Seems highly relevant, I would think, to an industry that wishes to be more interoperable and yet doesn't wish it to happen on any terms. There obviously are different ways, private sector versus public sector approaches, In many cases, it's happened, particularly in Europe, through legislation by threat. And by that I mean a legislature or a regulator will say, either become interoperable or else. So I started with that phone charger example. Phone chargers are actually much more interoperable now in Europe than they have been in the past. And the way that that came about was the EU said to the phone companies, if you don't do this, if you don't make your chargers more interoperable, we're going to force you to do it. So that legislation by threat has often been a mode, particularly at least in the European system, much less so in the US, but imagine relevant potentially here too. This is the geeky academic slide that shows these different approaches, but I actually think it shows the variation of the ways in which it can come about. You can see it pointing in different directions. Unilateral approaches, of course, being the way in which it happens in kind of a one-off way, whereas collaborative ones where the industry works together to the bottom. Non-regulatory, which is to say the private sector working on it to the left, and more regulatory to the right. I think that in general, the non-regulatory approaches have worked very well for industries and that have been ones that are obviously more comfortable rather than having the government come in and say, you must do it in a particular way. In the United States, these have come about much more commonly through the non-regulatory approaches. Again, Europe and other places, it's been more regulatorily driven. In other words, state actors actually driving it. I would just note some of the intersections to other fields. IP licensing has been one of the big drivers of this over time, just as an example. So for those of you who work in the IP space, I think that's actually a hugely relevant driver, often of higher levels of interoperability. Let me just say a couple things about interop strategy, and then we will go into our interactive part, if that's okay, Harold. There are, I think, a number of reasons why one would pursue an interop strategy and why it would be a good thing. I think it's hard to argue that if you are in a digital business, and I take it that everybody here is effectively, that interop is not deeply relevant, and there are different ways to approach it. I think there are a series of different factors that will shape your strategy. I think it obviously depends where you are in the cycle. Are you a strong entrenched player? Are you somebody who is trying to break in? Obviously, that's going to affect whether you're seeking a different level of interop or not. I think Apple is a really good example of a company where they had an extremely strong position. They are enormously interoperable within Apple products, but often they've been quite defensive about wanting to be horizontally interoperable, just as an example. This is not the best slide. I'm sorry for the black on the on those colors, but I think it shows a variety of different approaches that you might take from a corporate perspective, and giving just a few examples of it. On the bottom left, you see the most highly interconnected. I think Google and Android is almost certainly most sort of interop approach, this notion that when they released the Android operating system and created the system for it, basically anybody could code anything and put it on the Android system. You compare that, for instance, to the way in which Apple has played it with the iPhone, there's much more approval for an app and so forth, right? That's just an example, I think, of different strategies, different levels of interoperability. And if you look on the top left, you have ones that are much more about a defensive approach to interoperability. And I think, in general, Apple has been a good example of that, where there certainly are times when they need to interoperate. It's crucial in the IT space to do that to some degree, but they've done it only in ways that have sort of defended their market position in a variety of ways. And obviously, there are a range of different outcomes in terms of their role in terms of generating profit and their role in the industry. So that's not to say that there is any one perfect approach strategically to interop. It's just to say there are a bunch of ways to play it, any of which might be able to work for your company. I think that if you look at the way in which the web has developed, it's been an absolutely crucial thing to have higher levels of interoperability. So I do think that there are some industries in which a strategy that has no level of interop, I think you would be likely to fail. And so I think as you look at a higher and higher degree of interoperability in your industry, one question would be, is it possible to pursue a non-interop strategy? And my guess is it would be very hard to do. And if the story of the web and social media holds, I think that will be a likely guide. I do think also it's crucial to stay flexible and to say that as we've observed different companies through different case studies, that interop strategy has changed over time depending on market position, obviously, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but one that I guess obviously keeps you focusing on that over time. And again, I would go back to that layer strategy point. It's not just about your approach to the technology or to the data, but also about the human and institutional modes of interop as well. Harold, if I might, I would love to help have your help in translating all of this theory back to your wonderful field. And I thought we would start with the video LumaScape image that you pointed me to. And I have no idea how to explain that to this group, although I can tell it's relevant to interop. And I thought I would use that as my handoff to help you, to help us on the translation side.
John, thank you. Just give me a second, Mike. John, thank you, and I appreciate that. You know, one of the things, you know, you talked about emerging media and emerging platforms as being examples of good interoperability. I think the LumaScape is probably an example of, we have lots of players and lots of people who need to interoperate. But as we talked about, and Alana is probably the best example for this, is, you know, a lot of these guys sort of say, do we really need to interoperate with each other, or do we just stick another intermediary in the middle of a conversation? And, you know, so it's an interesting perception versus reality thing. But that's just one comment, you know, to your talk. I think that this is probably the first time in our industry that we've actually had that nuanced conversation of the layers of interop. And one of the things that's important for us to realize is that without all four layers, it doesn't happen. You know, and the human layer is almost, from our standpoint, is the most important one, where change is hard. And getting people to understand that they've got to get their, you know, people are sort of at the center, and that they've got to get their vendors to talk to each other. And John, you and I talked about this on the phone. Are there other examples of industries that are like the ad industry, or that have evolved like the ad industry, that have made the transition to highly interoperable systems?
This is a stumper of a question for me, and this is why I think a really, really good case study would be yours. I don't have a particular analogy, and okay. We've gone back through the things that we've studied. I don't think there is sort of an obvious industry that has gone through it in the way that you have. I do think that there are hallmarks of what you are going through that one can see in other fields. Most of the best interop stories, of course, relate to IT and something that is a little bit more sui generis, right? Mm-hmm. It's risen up from the start. I think any of the examples that I used earlier, for instance, healthcare, are relevant in the sense that they've had their information-based businesses, you know, in mm-hmm. that sense, and they have strong legacy systems, and they've got a complex set of players, and they're struggling toward higher and higher levels of interop. It is happening. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to draw the analogy too closely between you and healthcare, because I think there's so many ways in which that industry has struggled with this particular adjustment. But I think there are a series of basically information-based industries that are moving from siloed approaches to more interoperable approaches, and they're happening at different stages and different rates.
And that's the key piece, is that, you know, moving from siloed approaches to approaches of sort of monolithic vendors who are looking for vendor lock-in, where, you know, it's nice to say we've got you covered and we are working through all of these things within our own businesses and with our own silos, but interoperable systems, as you said, allow for innovation to take place, allow for greater choice. So great business case for it. Let me get a mic.
And I will say, that was what I was referencing about anti-competitive behavior. I do not know who I'm speaking to, so there may be people here who are very interested in anti-competitive behavior, so I didn't want to be too rude with it. But yes, I think that's one of the dynamics, right, is that some people prefer much higher levels of lock-in, and yet for these innovation and other benefits, it's generally speaking better to have higher degrees of interoperability, greater standardization, and less lock-in.
Yep.
John, to that very point,
yes,
do you see what seems to be, within 5 years, the widespread adoption of the blockchain technology to be more upsides to interoperability or downsides?
You know,
and I think a lot of people here might not even know what the blockchain is, so maybe you'll tell them that.
Really deep, real quick.
Yeah, that's really, really deep. And I should say, I am not a blockchain expert, so I'm the wrong person to be expounding it one way or the other. I do think that the development of the blockchain right now in places like the MIT Media Lab on an experimental side, and in lots of different big companies who are investing in it, banks in particular, is absolutely and a big interop question. And when I mention it as a design challenge, I think that's exactly, you know, a perfect example of it as it develops. So if you're thinking about a new set of technology that could be as important in some ways as the internet itself, as a mode of, in the case of banks, the transfer of funds and so forth, the technology is being designed with a view toward, can it have these interop benefits while also having the privacy and security, you know, concerns covered. So it's actually a perfect example of that emergence happening at exactly this moment. You want to be sure that the information is can flow in the way that the technology decides, but you also don't want it to flow so much that it actually has creates new problems. So it's a great example.
Another question over here.
Yeah. Hi, Jeff from Viacom. I'll stand up. Yeah, so is there any thinking around how to scope the domain in which you want to achieve interoperability? Mm. Because, you know, it's easy to talk about the healthcare industry.
Yeah.
In some respects, it's easy to talk about the ad industry, but in those at Viacom, you know, we're in the content business. There's a few lines of business there, and we see a lot of attempts at standardization and interoperability in different strains. Like even within an industry, you have information, material, and cash flows across the chain, and then, you know, with, you know, there's content flows. We're seeing, you know, we're part of something that the music industry is doing with blockchain, actually, mm-hmm. but it's siloed in a sense. But as a content company, we deal with music, content, images, there's a breadth of domains in which, you know, we like to see the same things, and we see standards bodies attempting to achieve interoperability, but even that's in silos, often using the same types of technology, so it's sort of like everyone chasing after the same thing. Mm-hmm. So is there any thinking about the scoping of the domain itself?
It's a wonderful question. Let me answer it, and then maybe, Harold, you can take a crack at answering it in a better way for the ad industry in particular. The way I would see it, in a way, would be to flip the question on its head and say, is there a way to see this from the perspective of what's going to benefit consumers the most? So one orientation of this would be not from the company perspective, we've got a series of different, you know, levels or zones in which to do it, but where are the greatest benefits for consumers going to flow, and is there a way that obviously that you all as companies can capture that and provide that in an effective way? So I would say that across any of the industries we've looked at, consumers have generally wanted higher degrees of interoperability and to have a more seamless experience and one that is also not creepy, right? So the ad tracking side is, you referenced earlier, is a flip side of that. But basically, where I think interop can help is to say you're creating more consumer choice and better and more seamless consumer experiences. If there's a way that Viacom can foster that and others can foster that and profit from it, that would seem to me where the alignment would be. But maybe someone who knows closer to it, Harold, yeah, you can give a better answer.
And I believe that when we think about highly interoperable systems in our space, we start to think about the value of addressable advertising. You know, the more addressable we get, the more granular data that we have about clusters of people without exposing personally identifiable information, the better we're going to be. You know, it's sort of like, you know, I was reading something that there is, you know, over 60% of people hate ads. You know, probably, that's probably a low stat. But if we start to serve ads that are, you know, as John said, not creepy, but in a manner where it is relevant to a person, and that the consumer finds it interesting. You know, I love, you know, what the IAB Tech Lab is doing in terms of lean scoring of ads. You've got this mutual benefit thing. You know, advertisers, agencies, and publishers and vendors have some skin in the game in terms of how ads are scored, how the ad serving is scored. And so I think that, you know, John's point of putting the consumer at the center and making the consumer experience pleasant. I firmly believe that we're, as an industry, we're going to move from, you know, we have this pendulum, right, that swings from consumer pays models to ad supported models. We're not going to see the pendulum swinging one way or the other. It's going to swing somewhere to the center, and what I call hybrid models. And I've seen some great examples. Anybody here from CBS? CBS is, you know, I think CBS All Access is probably a great example where you have an option of a lesser ad load with a small consumer pays component. And we, you know, and again, as a result of good information about ad targeting, you know, and again, that results from highly interoperable systems that are allowing for a lot of the innovation to take place. So I think that's where it goes. And, you know, we start to be able to do things to target ads, to be sure that we're tracking in a good way, and I think that we're serving ads in an efficient manner. And that's
One example I might just add, as somebody who's not in your industry, but I am that guy who has a cell phone and an iPad and a laptop and a TV and all the rest, is I've noticed my behavior around one thing has changed enormously, which is, does anybody use, I know I'm in Microsoft, but use Gmail, and you have that primary tab, and now you have the promotions, and you have the social. Since that happened, I've noticed that when I'm not that busy, when I'm busy, I'm just reading the primary, the kind of messages, but I've noticed that I will click on the promotions one in the middle, which seems to me such a strange behavior. I wouldn't necessarily be seeking people promoting to me, but increasingly the ads that are in there are actually relevant and interesting. They are related to brands or something that I somehow care about. And I surprise myself when I have a little more time that I click on the promotions tab. I don't know if that's an example of what you're talking about, but somebody has figured out that I'm actually not sorry to see those things when they're sorted in a particular way, and I feel like it may not, but I feel like I have a little more control over it. Anyway.
Right, and again, that, Alana.
Oh, hold on.
Times. So there's a couple of things I just want to respond to. One, you're right? That's the reason why it's there is because there was a great response psychologically to that placement, right? From the Gmail perspective. I wanted to respond to the Bitcoin, blockchain / Bitcoin thing, as well as interoperability piece on the trade association side. One, I think it behooves all of us as trade associations to work together more so than ever. So joint working groups across multiple trade associations are now happening on my side of the world for the first time, which is awesome. Because we can't do everything in digital or broadcast or cable. So if we have those interop groups, it'll make things work faster and hopefully more scalably. And then blockchain, we have a lot of work in the blockchain sector. Be careful. That's all I want to say about that.
I was going to follow up because this relates to all of them, because blockchain's the new hot word, right? 5 years ago it was API, right? A couple years ago it was microservices, right? Blockchain's the new and I wanted to come back to a point. So we're being very cautious about blockchain. We're letting other industries take it to the kind of consumer level that's outside of the dark net and the video game space. But I wanted to address, you guys brought up vendor lock-in, and we're kind of in a building phase for our businesses, right? Especially media and entertainment, advertising as well as content. This is something Jeff is also addressing as well, right? We're building out these digital supply chains. These giant companies are deciding whether to buy or to build these highly interoperable and connected systems. As a result, I think in the last couple of years, we've started to see a shift in mentality where, all right, I'm not gonna spend $200 million over the next 10 years to amortize this massive system so that my legal can talk to my distribution piece. What have you seen in other industries around the development side to start saying like, oh, okay, I'm seeing companies with an approach of a 5-year sunset where they're like, look, 80% of this is going to go away in 5 years, but we're going to keep that 20% and build it into the next version of the system, whether it's buy or build, whether it's the same vendor or another, right? It's almost like we're getting out of that lock-in mentality, but it's really being driven by development. And I'm curious if you've seen in any other industries, particularly like healthcare, government, et cetera, how did that kind of help that interconnected, does that mentality work? And is that something, it wouldn't exist without a concept of an API, right? And your billions of data calls a day. But do you see that as being an enlightenment? It's almost like a shift of consciousness of like, oh, wait a second. This is a new way that we're doing this, even though we're really doing what we've done forever, which is build.
I think the answer to your question is yes, for sure, and at least in theory. The reason I'm hesitating with all of these analogies trying to give you another industry is I don't actually have another industry where it's a great outcome in those ways, and I don't want to oversell the healthcare industry, say, or others. So I think that there are growing pains in all of these decisions. There's no question that the move to the cloud and the move to a more API-based system allows for lighter weight builds, and there are fewer huge builds of this sort. I think that that's plainly true, but I don't think there's really an industry out there, and somebody else may know of one, where you can just say this was a total slam dunk and it reduced all these costs and it was so fabulous. So I wish I could give you a super positive answer.
So these other industries are experiencing the same pain. They're just a little further down the pain road.
That would be my description of it, yes. And that's, I'm just being the candid academic.
No, please.
Which is kind of reassuring. You know, it's we're not alone in our pain.
Absolutely.
One of the areas that you looked at was IP licensing. And we as an industry, one of the benefits of being an industry where we have large players who take care of things for us is the world of IP licensing has never been a challenge. Yeah. You know, we're talking about this right now in the work that Jane Clark is talking about in SIM. What have you seen in terms of challenges in IP licensing, and has it been a barrier? How do you overcome some of the IP licensing challenges?
Sure. I mean, I think it is, I put it up there as one of the ways to get to interoperability. It is also obviously a barrier to interoperability. Mm-hmm. And from everything I've learned from you, Harold, on some phone calls and things you've told me, that it's actually a real positive story here, that you have found ways to work in the context of IP licensing to make it not a barrier, and in fact a plus, across the board. You know, I think in general the basic story is one of lock-in, that somebody is the one entity that moves a standard or gets to a place where they're able then to assert a patent or otherwise and say, if you don't come through my toll booth, then you can't come through, and that happens in industry after industry, and certainly the IT industry has a zillion examples of that most simply. I think to the extent that can be avoided, that is a good thing. I think it is ultimately, in economic terms, deadweight loss. I think it is, it generates revenue, obviously, to a given firm. There is an argument to say that it leads to more innovation if someone is inspired to do the work to create that standard and to lead it, but I think to the extent that you can build in from the start that people aren't going to be holding one another up in that particular way, I think you're going to be better off as it becomes more interoperable. Is that responsive?
No, makes perfect sense. Guy, you brought this up a little bit, and what I find interesting, and we talked about this in the opening panel, is that we all understand that things have to get, in our industry, the piece that's moving from place to place is the asset, whether it's the programming asset identified by an EITR code or an ad asset moving through the ecosystem with an ad ID code. But the important piece is that we move in a direction of where we're moving that from vendor to vendor in a seamless manner. And I think that, but it's a question of how to do it. And we're doing it. We're doing it in a way that certainly the internet isn't breaking, and we're certainly not seeing horrible consumer experiences. But the innovation that can accrue is the piece that comes through. And the other piece is, we have the Lumascape where, one of the things that I look at in terms of the Lumascape is, I don't know if that's a sustainable model. Having bits and pieces of new nuance or closet communities doing something that may not be done today. How do we make sure that we continue to raise the bar? Yes. Of where standardization is where innovation takes place.
Exactly right. So if I were to predict, and this is the prediction is worth exactly what you're paying for it, which is zero, I would predict that we'll go from its enormous complexity to much greater simplicity if, in fact, you continue on this road towards greater interoperability. That in a sense, interop can be at a higher level in the industry. It will be a good thing for most players in the industry serving content and ads and most consumers, and it will reduce the amount of complexity that is on that slide. And I don't know who goes and who wins and all the rest of that I won't bother to predict. But
George.
One more question?
Yep. Yep.
Yes, of course. Just do my ball tilt.
The far right or the far left, depending on which way you're looking, right?
Thank you. So this is quite a shift in topics, but I wanted to hear your perspective on something. You laid out a layered chart that had tech at the bottom.
Yep.
If I remember correctly, data
human and institutional.
Institution. Yep. Yeah. It's one thing at a tech level. This is sort of a passive thing, like if everybody uses the same phone charger.
Right.
But when you get into the upper levels, more data oriented and the human level, when you're interoperable, you also create business dependencies.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I'm now dependent on a data flow from somebody.
No question.
To do my business. And you talk about risks associated with security and privacy, but I know she didn't mention any kind of risk about the interoperability and the connections that you're building in these systems. And we've like a couple of years ago, instituted a new standard about one thing, just background about advertising is people are getting data about consumption of advertising faster and faster. Mm. We used to get it once a quarter. Now, and then we innovated and we get it once a week or once a month. Then we innovated, now we get it overnight. Then we innovated, now we get it real time and digital. And it's like crack. Businesses have to have it. And all these interoperability dependencies, we've had to start looking at organizations saying, you have to have continuity plans now. Is that anything you've contemplated? Or?
For sure, and you, of course, got the very short form version of this as I was trying to make sure that it was not too long and too boring. We wrote a whole book on it and have lots of case studies. I'm happy to share more with you. But I think this is absolutely right, that you know, on the list of risks, one certainly is a greater dependence on other parties. I think as a lawyer by training, part of the way to handle that, of course, is by contract, right? So there are certain ways that you mitigate that risk as well as you can. I don't think it's a totally new problem in the sense that, you know, the supply chain has always been something that creates a risk factor for entities. I think you're right to say, though, it's heightened with more interoperable systems, particularly as the data flows are more and more important in that way. I mean, certainly think about any of the game companies that created up around, you know, Facebook, and whether or not if they all of a sudden get kicked off Facebook and they have absolutely no users, right, they're gone. It's just, they're like out of business. So there's a, for some people in the system, it can be kind of a death warrant if it doesn't go right. In others, it's a kind of a lower level risk, which is, okay, I got to get some other data provider. So I think you're absolutely right, and it is something that I think goes back to that key point I was trying to make about it being a design challenge. You have to go into it with your eyes open as to what are the changes then in the dynamic as it gets more interoperable that you need to design for and find ways to mitigate, whether it's legal or otherwise. So I think it's a great point.
John, thank you.
Harold, thank you. I really appreciate the chance to be here.
John Pelfrey.